Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin and go to New Zealand to speak with William Harris, a professor of politics at the University of Otago, where he teaches the politics and history of the Levant states, whose latest book is Quicksilver War, Syria, Iraq, and the Spiral of Conflict. As funerals begin for some of the 50 victims of last Friday's shooting rampage at two mosques, we will discuss how New Zealand's Prime Minister has acted quickly to reassure the country's small Muslim population, in contrast to Trump's inability to even acknowledge that the victims are Muslims, and the PM's swift response to enacting gun control measures, which our Congress appears incapable of doing no matter how many massacres happen here and how many die every year from gun violence. We will also examine the cynical use of the tragedy by Turkey's President Erdogan at campaign rallies in the elections underway in Turkey. With New Zealand's foreign minister heading to Turkey for talks, presumably to complain to Erdogan about his comparisons to New Zealand soldiers invading Gallipoli in 1915 with the lone gunman's attack on Muslims, we will contrast Erdogan's cooperative tone in his op-ed in the Washington Post with what he is saying to his domestic audience as he continues to insist that the gunmen responsible for the massacres at the mosques did not act alone. Then we'll seek a psychological explanation for Trump's flurry of furious tweets over the last weekend, which prompted the husband of one of Trump's top advisors to include the textbook diagnosis of narcissistic personality disorder in his warning to the public that our president's mental condition is worsening. Dr. Bandy Lee, a forensic psychiatrist on the faculty of Yale School of Medicine and co-founder of Yale's Violence and Health Study Program, who was the editor of the new book, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, 37 Psychiatrists and Mental Health Experts Assess a President, joins us. Then finally, we'll look into the other bad news along with the details of the Cohen search warrants, which have Trump rattled. And that is the revelations about the billions loaned to Trump from Deutsche Bank at a time when Trump was blackballed by Wall Street. James Henry, an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist who specializes in global banking, debt crises, and tax havens, and is the author of Blood Bankers, joins us to discuss the intensifying scrutiny of Trump's relationship with Deutsche Bank. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is William Harris, who's a professor of politics at the University of Otago in New Zealand, where he teaches the politics of history of the Levant states, and his books include Lebanon, A History, and The Levant, A Fractured Mosaic, and his latest book is Quicksilver War, Syria, Iraq, and the Spiral of Conflict. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Harris.
Thank you very much for having me.
And you're in New Zealand, of course, you're a considerable distance from Christchurch, where the massacre took place last Friday, and I believe the funerals have begun for some of the 50 victims. But I understand that the terrorist actually was planning on attacking a mosque very close to where you are.
Yes, that's right. We're about 350 kilometers south of Christchurch on the same island. Mm-hmm. But yes, he apparently had the intention to do it at the mosque just down the street from us, but for whatever reason decided he would travel to Christchurch.
So, since you're an expert on the Middle East, what are we to make of what President Erdogan of Turkey's been doing? It's pretty outrageous that he actually played some of the terrorist footage that he live streamed as he murdered all these people. Most people have suppressed that video as much as possible, but Erdogan actually played clips at campaign rallies and tried to sort of stoke kind of anti-Western paranoia, and even went so far as to suggest to link the terrorist in New Zealand with the Anzac soldiers in 1915 that landed at Gallipoli, the Australians and New Zealanders, and the idea, I think he said something about, you know, we sent them home in coffins then and we'll do it again. So I take it that the Foreign Minister of New Zealand has been dispatched to talk to Erdogan. So what kind of a conversation are they going to have?
Well, I think it'll be a measured and calculated discussion from our point of view. The official reaction here has been, of course, a bit sharp because we regard it as potentially physically endangering our citizens that somebody should stir up things like this. The Prime Minister has been playing it down a bit. This is somewhat in contrast to the Australian reaction, and it's notable, I think, to add that President Erdogan has just done an op-ed with the Washington Post, in which he takes a quite different line. He's talked about cooperation with our intelligence services, common fight against ISIS, that Turkey's strategic goal remains to be in the European Union, and then he finished that article by praising our Prime Minister, praising her courage, leadership, and sincerity. I've got it down here in front of me, as I assume this would probably come up, and also congratulates her for embracing the Muslim community. So I think we're finding it a bit puzzling what to make of Mr. Erdogan. It's quite obviously there's an electoral consideration with these local elections coming up in Turkey at the end of the month, and that being a sort of referendum on the ruling party in the context of the slide of Turkish real incomes in the last several months, which I think has rattled, the implications of that have rattled him a little bit. So we're a bit confused as to what to make of his position, and I think on our side, vis-a-vis Australia, our side is to wait a bit, and with some anticipation that he's going to change his line or step back somewhat.
Well, he's clearly showing a different face to the foreign audience to the one that he showed to the domestic audience, and he does have a kind of religious rural constituency that is sort of fundamentalist in a way, and he is turning.
Yeah, he's playing to his base.
Right, exactly, but he's fairly widely loathed amongst the city folk and the more educated people. So
yeah, and I would say there, I mean, I have quite long and deep experience of Turkey, and my feeling would be that there's a very large part of the public sector bureaucracy that really values the relationships they have with us and with Australia, and they will do their best to limit the implications and to clear up what's going on here. So and we realize that, and so we're not in any rush to throw over our relationship with Turkey. No, absolutely not.
And again, I'm speaking with William Harris, who is in New Zealand. He's a professor of politics at the University of Otago, where he teaches the politics of history and of the Levant states. And his books include Lebanon, A History, and The Levant, A Fractured Mosaic. And his latest book is Quicksilver War, Syria, Iraq, and the Spiral Conflict. There are actually in Australia a fairly considerable number of Turks who've emigrated to Australia. What is the overall population of Muslims in New Zealand?
Well, it's been estimated on the international media that it's something like 1% of the overall population, so a very small fraction, and I think that's probably about right. And Turks are a component of that, and we have a reasonable number of Turkish people here in Dunedin. If you go down the main street, you'll see there are five or six places that sell Turkish kebabs and a couple of restaurants. So there's certainly a visible presence of Turks, for example, here. But the community, the Islamic community, is pretty small in New Zealand. A very small minority.
But in terms of this being an act of terrorism, and obviously the fact that it was perpetrated by a foreigner, although I guess Australia and New Zealand aren't too far apart, and I think there's some reciprocity in terms of immigration. Nevertheless, you could make the case, surely, that what just happened in New Zealand last Friday is the worst terrorist attack by foreigners on New Zealand soil, going back to the last one being the sinking of the Rainbow Warrior by a French intelligence agency, the Greenpeace ship in Auckland Harbour.
Yes, that's certainly the case. And I think there's another thing to point out here as well, that this is correct me if I'm wrong, this is the largest scale attack on Muslims and mosques anywhere in the West in modern history. So it's a pretty significant and extremely nasty event.
And how is it being processed? It's been a few days now, and there's been an awful lot of attention on the country. And I must say, most people are giving Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern a lot of praise for the way she's handled it. And, of course, in contrast to our president, who basically is ignoring it. He's never mentioned it ever, nor has his spokesperson mentioned that the victims were Muslims. And also, of course, the president dodged the opportunity to condemn white nationalism, which is what motivated this Australian terrorist in New Zealand.
I agree with you. We're very proud of our Prime Minister. We believe that she's handled this in a wonderfully empathetic manner and brought the country together and greatly reassured the Muslim minority, which is that Muslims are pretty scared at the moment. I mean, some of the children are afraid to go to school and things like that. And she's doing her absolute utmost to calm everything and to bring the country together. And as you've noted with President Trump, we've observed him and seen the behavior, and we're really disappointed. We're really disappointed that the United States is absent basically on this affair.
Well, it is something that we're here in this country. Of course, the majority of Americans do not approve of Trump. His poll numbers are, in terms of approval, around 40. They've actually gone up to 42, but still he is not. There are more people against him than there are for him, but those that are for him are fairly ardent in their support of him. So what do you think is happening then in terms of, after the massacre in Tasmania and Australia some time back, the Conservative Prime Minister there immediately banned guns or handguns and assault rifles. What's happening in terms of the 10-day window that Prime Minister Ardern said that within that they would deal with gun control? And it looks as though they're moving to... She actually said it was a surprise to many, including people in New Zealand, how lax their gun laws were.
Well, I mean, we've been pretty lax in terms of registering guns, so we don't know what's in whose possession. And it's actually been surprisingly easy to obtain semi-automatic weaponry as well. So I think she really wants to move swiftly in dealing with those matters and generally quite strictly tightening up our gun laws here. We do have something of a gun lobby connected with hunting and that sort of thing, and of course their reaction to her proposals has been rather cautious, shall we say. And we even here in Dunedin we have a quite large gun store called Gun City, I think it's termed. So yes, there have been defects in our approach to the availability of weaponry. And I think a lot of us are a bit surprised as well, as we've found out just how soft we are in terms of weaponry availability.
So do you expect something to be done in New Zealand along the lines of what happened in Australia under the Conservative Prime Minister Howard?
I would think so. It won't be exactly the same, because where we've got to is possibly a bit different from where Australia was when they did that measure. But yes, roughly similar. We're going to really make a difference here, I believe.
And what's happening? I mean, there must be some concern in Australia itself that this character was Australian. But surely the Australian people, and you're much closer, obviously, to Australia than we are here in the US, how are they processing the remarks by that right-wing Australian Senator Fraser Anning, who blamed the entire incident in New Zealand on Muslims, the victims?
Well, I'm assuming that the bulk of Australians are horrified and deeply disturbed by what's happened, in the same way as the bulk of our people are. I mean, we know that Australia has to some degree of a right-wing edge amongst the population, which may be somewhat sharper than what's the case in New Zealand. But in very overall terms, I think the same degree of horror prevails over there as does here. And the desire, certainly the desire on our side here in New Zealand, that we have a really nice relationship with our Muslim community, and that we reassure them of their safety, and do our best to up the level of integration and coming together amongst our people.
Well, you know, we have Congressman Steve King over here, who's a xenophobe and a racist. He's made equally inflammatory remarks, and the president himself, of course, is still incapable of criticizing white nationalists. He was at Charlottesville when it was all so obvious, neo-Nazis with flags chanting, "The Jews will not replace us," and yet he wasn't able to condemn them. So there's something peculiar going on in this country.
Yeah, we absolutely noted the anti-Semitism and so forth that went on there. And, I mean, the reaction here was pretty disapproving.
So when you talked earlier, William Harris, about the young Muslim kids in New Zealand being afraid to go to school, I mean, you didn't really have much of a problem, did you, in New Zealand? There wasn't any prejudice and racism of any notable scale, is there? We've had some incidents here, of course, because, you know, as I say, from the very top leadership in this country, there's been a lot of anti-Muslim rhetoric, a Muslim ban, for example, on a number of countries, which is totally uneven. So I was going to ask you, are relations to Muslims going to improve? But they weren't bad in the first place, were they?
No, I don't think so. I mean, we have a hard right, small hard right segment in the population. There is. I mean, the proportions may be different from country to country, but we do have that, and there have been some incidents of girls and ladies being accosted in the street over the hijab and things like that. We have had isolated incidents, and there is an anti-immigrant feeling amongst a portion of the more conservative part of the population. So it's not absent here, but what's a big difference, as far as I can see, is that on this whole affair, we have serious leadership in this country in a decent direction, and we're concerned that may not be quite the same in the United States.
Well, William Harris, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with William Harris, who's a professor of politics at the University of Otago in New Zealand, where he teaches the politics and history of the Levant states, and his books include Lebanon, A History, and The Levant, A Fractured Mosaic, and his latest book is Quicksilver War, Syria, Iraq, and the Spiral of Conflict. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back with a psychological explanation for Trump's flurry of furious tweets over last weekend.
He changed his clothes and shined his boots and combed his dark hair down, and his mother cried as he walked out. Don't take your guns to town, son. Leave your guns at home, Bill. Don't take your guns to town. He laughed and kissed his mom and said, "You're Billy Joe's a man. I can shoot as..."
What goes on in your heart? What goes on?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, Dr. Bandy Lee, a forensic psychiatrist on the faculty of Yale School of Medicine, who served as director of research for the Center for the Study of Violence and co-founded Yale's Violence and Health Study Group and leads an academic collaborators group for the World Health Organization. She's the lead author of The Duty to Warn conference at Yale University, out of which came the best-selling book, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, which has just been updated and expanded with new essays. Now, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, 37 psychiatrists and mental health experts assess a president. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Bandy Lee.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, thank you, Bandy. And what's your sense then of what happened over the weekend, last weekend, with that tweet storm, the deep sense of aggrievement that Trump has? I mean, he's the most powerful person in the world, and yet he acts like a petulant child. Somebody's taken his toys away. And he attacked Mueller, of course. The implication is that he's getting more and more paranoid about what Mueller may be up to. And then struck out at John McCain, which makes no sense, but he did it. He keeps doing it. And talked about people on Fox News should be put back on the air, and also attacked General Motors, or at least the CEO of General Motors. It was all over the place, 50-something tweets over a weekend. And here you have the most powerful man in the world sitting alone in the White House. Apparently, I don't know what, no friends, no family. What's going on with this man? He seems to be sort of more and more isolated, both physically and mentally.
Yes, and this is what we had been warning against for years now, not just myself and not just the 37 mental health experts who contributed to the book this time around, but thousands of mental health professionals have been concerned about this, that someone with his mental instability would eventually not be able to handle a position of great power that he has been given, that the pressures of the presidency would become too great. Either way, whether he is gaining in power or receiving greater scrutiny and criticism, both scenarios are bound to make him worse, which is what we had been warning against.
So what did you make of Kellyanne Conway's husband, George Conway, tweeting out the diagnostic definition of narcissistic personality disorder? I mean,
well, it has gotten to the point where it does not take a mental health professional or a physician to recognize that Mr. Trump is unwell and that he is dangerous. And I believe what Mr. Conway is doing is a public service in alerting the fact that since none of our warnings had been heeded, and since there has been a lot of cover-up, including by White House doctors, that now the next step is for someone who is intelligent and who probably works with expert witnesses such as mental health experts. He is showing how the signs that that Mr. Trump is exhibiting are signs that are consistent with pathology and mental disorder.
So the subtext, though, surely, Dr. Bandy Lee, is that the 25th Amendment is hovering out there. And the 25th Amendment can only be triggered by the vice president, who then has to get all the cabinet to sign on to the idea that the commander-in-chief and the president of the United States is mentally unfit to continue his duties. We have a vice president who is incredibly sycophantic towards Trump. And there's also quite a concern amongst a lot of people. You know, as you know, Trump is a minority president in the sense that majority of Americans didn't vote for him in the first place, and more and more don't like him and wish he would go away and stop doing the damage that he does on a daily basis. So that's the situation we're in. So it's sort of, many people think it's out of the frying pan into the fire.
Mm-hmm. First of all, upon speaking with the drafter of the 25th Amendment, who I was on the same speaking panel on, it is not the vice president who initiates it. According to the intent, it appears that it really is either the cabinet, or if the cabinet is incapable of it, another body that Congress institutes is the one that leans on the vice president to initiate the 25th Amendment. So it isn't exactly that the vice president initiates it. The vice president has to consent to it, but it's really the other body that gathers the evidence and the case, makes the case for the 25th Amendment, Section 4, I should specify.
And who was the person that you that initiated the 25th Amendment that you were on a panel with?
That's Dr. John Farrick, who drafted the amendment 50 years ago, and he's still lecturing and teaching on the topic.
Because the person who carried it politically was Senator Birch Bayh, who just died a few days ago. Mm-hmm. And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Mandy Lee. He's a forensic psychiatrist on the faculty of Yale Law School of Medicine, who served as director of research for the Center for the Study of Violence and co-founded Yale's Violence and Health Study Group, and leads an academic collaborators group for the World Health Organization, and she's the lead author of the Duty to Warn conference at Yale University, out of which came the best-selling book, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, which has been just updated and expanded with new essays in a new edition, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, 37 Psychiatrists and Mental Health Experts Assess a President. So you've warned, and you've responded to you, the duty to warn. And yet we still have this president who's behaving more and more in an aberrant way. And some of the most profound arguments have been made from the beginning. In fact, Hillary Clinton campaigned largely on the idea that you can't have Donald Trump have access to nuclear weapons. So in terms of expanding the diagnosis from Trump to those who support him, it would seem to me that the best way to get rid of Trump, or to get rid of the danger that Trump poses, is to somehow influence his base to abandon him. So do you have any psychological answer to that?
Yes, I have a very strong opinion about that, because that is normal political thinking, that you need to convince the public in order to remove a president or to change the political situation. But in fact, it is the fact of an impaired president being in office that worsens the state of the public and the state of the public's ability to protect its own interests. In other words, not be beguiled into a state of disorder, in a sense, a societal disorder. We call it shared psychosis. So when you have an impaired individual who is in an influential position, or in a household, we see it all the time. When a sick individual is not given treatment and simply placed among healthy family members, it isn't the sick individual who becomes healthier because of the other individuals, but it's rather the other way around. The healthy individuals start taking on the symptoms of the sick person.
Well, what I find extraordinary, Dr. Bandy Lee, is that, you know, my beat as a journalist is mostly national security, and I've talked to an awful lot of people in the intelligence world, and all the senior heads of the intelligence world, the former ones, the ones that are able to speak, like the Director of National Intelligence, the former head of the CIA, they've all made a pretty strong case that Trump might well be a traitor, which is about as bad as it gets. He's under some kind of compromised by Putin. And then on top of that, you've got all these investigations into his business dealings, which indicate that he may well be a career criminal. So there's so many reasons to get rid of him. What, it must be frustrating. I'm frustrated by it. How do you feel?
Well, for me, before there are any indictments and before we think about the president's criminality, we really need to consider the danger that he poses, the imminent threat, which is the imminent threat to our nation's and the international community's well-being is what we need to think about. So I'm considering mostly our society's medical need, and I'm responding to that medical need by alerting about the dangers of this presidency. Now, to alert the public about the apparent mental incapacity of this president because of his instability is different from stating that he is criminal-minded and it doesn't exonerate him from criminal responsibility, but it does make him more dangerous. And that is what we need to, that is what we feel we need to let the public know, just how dangerous this president is due to a combination of criminal-mindedness and mental instability.
So in other words, by saying that we have a president who has, you know, a mental impairment, I can't think of the right way to put it, and I'm sure you have a better definition, but in saying that, that doesn't let him off the hook, does it? I mean, in other words, it's the, you know, when
no, it's very difficult to be, so what we call it is not guilty by reason of insanity. It's very difficult to get that verdict because in most cases, even if you are mentally impaired, you can tell apart right from wrong and have free choice. It is under very, very severe symptomatology that you would not be able to do that. And it also has to be confined to the very moment of decision-making.
But the two characteristics that Trump most exhibits, one of which ties into the narcissistic personality disorder, is his sense of self-aggrandizement. It's just manifest. By the way, on that tweet storm over the weekend, he once again revisited many times his great Electoral College victory. He keeps talking about that, which, remember, the first day in office, he insisted that he had a bigger crowd than Obama in spite of the evidence, and he forced his press secretary to go out there and lie to the public on his first day on the job, which was just insane. But along with self-aggrandizement, there's this other characteristic, which is self-preservation. He's actually wily as a fox in terms of being, you know, you've seen how he's tried to put his people in at the Southern District of New York. He wanted to make sure he got rid of the Preet Bharara there, the U.S. attorney, and put in his guy. And he's very proactive. It's not going to be easy to get rid of him in terms of using the law. So are those two characteristics, they seem kind of contradictory, but would you agree that those two characteristics seem to dominate self-aggrandizement at the same time self-preservation?
Well, he certainly has a lot of symptoms that point to more than perhaps just one or two conditions. Pathology normally is healthy instincts, healthy impulses gone awry. Therefore, there will be an element of self-preservation or self-protection that is involved. But eventually it becomes disease because it leads to self-destruction as well as damage to others. And what we're seeing is a pattern of destruction of, well, the nation, institutions, and even the constitutional checks and balances and the judicial system. And whereas it appears that he is preserving himself at the expense of all those elements, he will eventually also be self-destructive. That is the nature of illness as opposed to healthy choice.
Well, it is, again, a very frustrating situation where you've got criminality, you've got treachery, at least the very likelihood of treachery, and on top of that,
yes,
you've got...
And as you can see, no amount of information that is coming out of the level of illness that he is exhibiting, level of impairment, or signs of unfitness, or signs of criminality, none of this seems to be making a dent in his support, and that is partly because the mental pathology is spreading in society, and therefore making society less and less capable of protecting itself from damage and disease. And therefore, just like the family where a sick individual would make the other healthy individuals ill, and the first step of treatment of that is to remove that individual from the family and to apply correct treatment and to empower the healthy individuals to be able to recognize the signs and to protect themselves from symptoms of deterioration in the sick individual, we should really apply that also to at a national scale. And so the first step of correct treatment would be to remove the individual who is spreading the disease. And that, frankly, is the president himself. That would be the first step. And it needs to be done sooner rather than later, because with time we will lose the ability to be able to help ourselves.
Well, Dr. Bandy Lee, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Bandy Lee, who's a forensic psychiatrist on the faculty of Yale School of Medicine, who served as director of research for the Center for the Study of Violence and co-founded Yale's Violence and Health Study Group and leads an academic collaborators group for the World Health Organization. And she's the lead organizer of the Duty to Warn conference at Yale University, out of which came the best-selling book, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, which has just been just updated and expanded with new essays. Now, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, 37 Psychiatrists and Mental Health Experts Assess a President. We're going to take a brief station break and back look into revelations about the billions loaned to Trump by Deutsche Bank at a time when Trump was blackballed by Wall Street. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is James Henry, an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist who has written extensively about global banking, debt crises, tax havens, and economic development, the former chief economist at McKinsey & Company. He's the co-founder with David K. Johnson of the new investigative reporting news service, dcreport.org, and he's the author of Blood Bankers. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Henry.
Good to be with you.
Well, thank you, James. And there's been some reporting about Trump's relationship with Deutsche Bank, particularly in the New York Times. There's a forthcoming book, in fact, by David Enrich about Deutsche Bank. But it's now, I mean, there's so much going on. I don't know where to even begin with Mueller and all the recent release of the contents of Mueller's warrant for his raid on Michael Cohen. But where do you think Deutsche Bank is heading in terms of this release, impending release of the Mueller report? Do you think they're going to be a big part of it?
You know, I think Congress is investigating, and they're going to be, you know, having Deutsche Bank testify. The New York State Attorney General has got a civil investigation of Deutsche Bank. A lot of this was a response to, you know, Michael Cohen's testimony recently, in which he basically said that Trump had been falsifying his assets on loan statements. But we've known a lot about the peculiar relationship with Deutsche Bank that Trump has had for some time. Actually, an earlier report by the Times back in July of 2017 by Jesse Drucker and Ben Protas, also Jessica Silva-Greenberg, covered much of the same ground that Enric has covered in this. All told, you have this German bank at a time when basically nobody else would lend to Donald Trump because he'd had between 4 and 6 bankruptcies in the 1990s, depending on how you're counting. They decided to, starting in 1998, to extend loan commitments and bond sales of more than $5 billion to this guy. And so there's a long series of failed projects. Beginning in 1998, there were a couple loans on the order of $250 million for some properties in New York. 2003, they issued several hundred billion dollars of bonds for a Trump project, which within 1 year went belly up. But they kept on, he kept on having Deutsche Bank as a lender. So it's a very unusual history. I mean, in 2008, he has a $640 million loan that for his Chicago Tower that he can't service, and he actually sues Deutsche Bank, blaming them for the financial crisis. It's really quite incredible. He also managed to have one of the top U.S. private bankers in the country who was recruited by Deutsche Bank, a woman named Rosemary Vlahovic. Vlahovic had come from Citibank in 2006 and joined Deutsche Bank. And she's just very aggressive in terms of helping her wealthy clients borrow money from the bank. And she was actively involved in getting more than $200 million for him after she joined. And she's also been lending to Jared Kushner. She has a $300 million relationship with Kushner. So, there's a lot to figure out here. I think one of the things that's interesting about this is that Deutsche Bank was entering the U.S. at a time when it basically had no other competitive advantage in the late 90s than its lending portfolio. It didn't have a very good reputation as a trader. It had acquired Bankers Trust and Alex Brown, which is kind of a failed investment bank, and did that on, as a kind of a favor to the Federal Reserve. But the only thing it could do to grow its share of the market in New York was to throw money at dubious projects and dubious clients like Donald Trump.
So, the money that you're talking about, according to the New York Times recent article on Trump's relationship with Deutsche Bank, they claim that the bank handed over a total of well over $2 billion to Donald Trump, who no other bank or Wall Street house wanted to touch. You said $5 billion. That's quite a lot more than $2
billion. Well, the number in the original Drucker piece from July of 2017, which I think is right, is for total loans, loan commitments, and potential bond offerings. So that's more than $4 billion. The mm-hmm. Times piece that he's talking about is the actual loan commitments that were made and where the money actually changed hands, probably excluding this $500 million of bonds that were sold and then defaulted on. The current outstanding amount that Trump owes Deutsche Bank is about $300 million. So he's paid much of it back. And, you can throw the numbers around, but it's still – the key point is that at a time when other banks were not making loans to Trump, and when Deutsche Bank's own internal assessments by its investment bank and by its commercial real estate group was that this was a guy whose projects were prone to failure and that his personal statements of assets were way overstated, you still have this peculiar support for him, not only in the private banking group, but also at the very top of the bank, especially under a guy named Joseph Ackerman, who was CEO from 2004 to 2012, and personally approved, some of the loans that were made in late 2011. So, Ackerman is best known now for being chairman of the Bank of Cyprus, a bank that's had a lot of Russian investors. Ackerman was, during his tenure at Deutsche Bank, on Putin's investment council. He has investors in the Bank of Cyprus, like Ripple Olof, who was a big oligarch, and Vekselberg, another big oligarch. So, you know, this is a very peculiar kind of group that we should be looking at more closely, and I think it's very appropriate for the Congress to have these people brought in. In fact, they should insist that Ackerman be produced, not just Blavatnik.
And again, I'm speaking with James Henry, an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist who has written extensively about global banking, debt crises, tax havens, and economic development. The former chief economist at McKinsey & Company, he's the co-founder with David K. Johnston of the new investigative reporting news service, dcreport.org, and he's the author of Blood Bankers. So given the Russian connections, and of course Vekselberg's, the oligarch, his name came up in the Mueller warrant for the raid on Michael Cohen, and apparently he lent Michael Cohen or invested over half a million dollars for consulting through Michael Cohen's company, probably for access to Trump.
Well, Vekselberg invested. We have Wilbur Ross, who's Secretary of Commerce, who made a significant investment in turning around the Bank of Cyprus in 2014. He became vice chairman of the bank at a time when Ackerman became chairman, and his counterpart as vice chairman was a KGB agent. Vekselberg at that point became the owner of about 11% of the bank, so I don't know what he paid for that exactly, but, you know, he's still the largest shareholder of the bank. Ripple Olof has reduced his ownership, but Ripple Olof figures in this story as well. He's the potash czar of Russia, is worth about $8 billion, best known lately for having bought and sold the Salvator Mundi, the most expensive piece of art in the world. But in June of 2008, just when Donald Trump was running into financial difficulties with Deutsche Bank, trying to service his $640 million of loans outstanding for the Chicago project, Ripple Olof comes along and buys Donald Trump's house in Miami for just precisely the kind of $40 million profit that Trump was on the hook for with respect to this personally, with respect to this big Chicago loan. So, you know, this is we should drain this swamp, and I'm hoping that the congressional investigators are able to do so.
But, James Henry, what I sense in all of this is, particularly when you talk about Ackerman, the guy who approved all these loans to Trump, and his ties to the Russians and directly to Putin, my sense is that one of the reasons why Deutsche Bank was the only bank that would lend money to Donald Trump was that they had the assurance from the Russians that they'd back him up. Which gets to the point, which I think is really at the heart of the Mueller inquiry, and pretty much what a lot of people in the intelligence world have been telling us, that, you know, the Russians have been backing Trump.
Well, I think there's a benign interpretation of this, which we have to, there is no documentation for the evidence that you've, for the argument that you've made. I mean, there's certainly a lot of smoke pouring out of the basement, but the benign interpretation is that Deutsche Bank was just coming from behind in the U.S. market, and their own credit approvals committee only had like a $3 million loan approval. Everything had to be kicked upstairs to Germany. Certainly the connections that Deutsche Bank has here are standing out. I mean, there's also this loan of $90 million they made to Prevazon, the company that was accused of laundering the Magnitsky money into real estate. So, you know, wherever you look, there seems to be Deutsche Bank being able to sign up for dodgy loans to people connected to the Trump empire, not only Kushner, but also the Prevazon people.
Right, but that ties it to Russia, though, doesn't it? That ties it directly to the Kremlin and ties it into those people who met in Trump Tower with Manafort, Jared, and Don Jr., etc., all that group of Russians, they were ostensibly there to undo the Magnitsky Act.
Well, I think the undeniable fault here is that, you know, if you have to account for the long-term history of Donald Trump's rise to power, you have to give a lot of credit to two different sources of finance. One is Deutsche Bank, certainly, and why that was allowed to continue by the Federal Reserve, why no one was really monitoring this kind of consistent track record of loan pushing, you know, is a good question for federal regulators as well. But then the other stream was the oligarchs and the dodgy money dealers, the Felix Saters of the world who helped to finance his growth. And so there, you know, he was turning to oligarchs from Kazakhstan and Azerbaijan and other places where they were basically throwing capital flight money out the door at almost any projects that were had a Trump stamp on them, and, you know, ended up financing the Trump Tower in Canada, Trump Soho, a bunch of projects in places like Panama. So it's those two streams of dodgy finance that end up being, you know, worth understanding, and I'm glad that Congress is finally going to do so.
Right. Well, there's a shorthand term for what you're talking about, and it's called money laundering.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the people that need to be examined here, though, I think are also those who are, you know, kind of treating this kind of lending with benign neglect. I mean, this is the early period of the 2000s when a lot of this got going. There was an awful lot of, you know, appetite for turning a blind eye to irresponsible lending on the part of U.S. bank regulators. And I think this is an object lesson. It's sort of the extreme limit of that is you get a president who basically owed his creation to dubious lending.
So do you think, though, that back to Deutsche Bank or the other part of the financial strand, along with dodgy money from Russian oligarchs, the German bank, and by the way, one of the things that the New York Times, recent New York Times article mentioned was that the woman that you mentioned about, Rosemary Vrablic, who seemed to handle Trump personally at Deutsche Bank, she was at his inauguration in a VIP section. But apparently from that point onwards, Deutsche Bank got nervous. They helped put this guy in the White House, but immediately they realized that maybe now that he was in the world's biggest goldfish bowl, there'd be some blowback on him. But it does seem that the son of the Supreme Court Justice, Anthony Kennedy, Justin Kennedy, was an important player there. So was he a sort of decoration, or was he really somebody that was a kind of go-between between the political establishment?
Well, according to the Times report, you have Kennedy coming on for this dubious bond sale to some of Deutsche Bank's most important clients in New York, where they were financing Donald Trump Casino, and Justin Kennedy was the facilitator of that. He had displaced a guy named Michael Ovitt, who had come from Goldman in 1998 and then became a kind of close crony of Trump and was responsible for about $500 million of loans and a failed loan that didn't go through that had a you know, somehow ended up with a forged signature on it. And then I think apparently Vrablic, who arrived at Deutsche Bank in 2006 as a consummate private banker, already had Kushner as a client. So the introduction came basically to Trump came through Kushner at that point in 2006. You know, she was able to cultivate the relationship there. It's not unusual for private wealth management, for private bankers to arrange so-called back-to-back lending for their wealthy clients. I think this raises the question of how much assets Donald Trump has placed under management with Deutsche Bank and where he has it. You know, is any of it offshore? So there's a whole lot that we hope to learn from her testimony before the House Intelligence Committee. And maybe we'll also get into this question of the asset valuation and find out what Donald Trump is really worth. Because his tax returns have never been made public, it's been difficult for outsiders to audit him. But he had to have submitted you know, statements of net worth and, you know, liabilities to the banks. And so those will be, and, you know, he couldn't lie on those reports. So there are several ways in which this could get interesting.
Well, one of his tax returns, or at least a part of it, was dropped in your partner in DCReport.org's mailbox, David K. Johnston.
Yeah, that's right. And we have one, two pages from 2005. And it's suggestive that he had a whole lot of LLCs that he was servicing around the planet, but we need to know much more detail than we've got there. I mean, you know, at some point, I'm sure in the long scheme of history, we will get to the bottom of Trump's balance sheet. But we're only a little bit closer today.
Well, James Henry, I thank you for joining us, and we'll have to stay in touch on this. I know the Congress has got all kinds of investigation, and the White House is simply not going to comply with requests and subpoenas. They're really playing hardball.
It's interesting. One of the intriguing things about this is that European authorities also have jurisdiction, obviously, over these institutions, and I would think they would have an interest in exploring some of the questions that have been raised about money laundering and about bad lending, and so the German financial authorities, the Dutch financial authorities, we've recently seen evidence of Rudy Giuliani helping Felix Sater launder money through the Netherlands for the sake of the Krapanovs in the Kazakhstan, a group of kleptocrats. There's an awful lot of investigative material that could be looked into by European authorities if we don't want to put everything on Mueller and the U.S. Congress, because this is really a global problem.
Sure.
And this case has exposed the truly global nature of kleptocracy and political intrigue. It's not just about Donald Trump. We have right now the European parliamentary elections going on. In May, there's evidence that people like Bannon and the Mercers have been intervening there, and as they did in the UK, Brexit. This is really a global problem that we've seen. I've been examining the intervention that Cambridge Analytica did on the behalf of the current president of Kenya to get him elected, using Facebook manipulation and the same kind of stuff that they're accused of doing in the United States. I mean, it's clear to me that whatever the Russians did in the United States election in 2016, we had U.S. Hedge fund donors making it possible to intervene in poor countries like Kenya and disrupt their elections. So this is really a global problem, and I hope the Congress realizes that there's much more at stake than simply one election in the United States.
Well, James Henry, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You're quite welcome. Thanks.
And again, I've been speaking with James Henry. He's an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist who has written extensively about global banking, debt crises, tax havens, and economic development. The former chief economist at McKinsey & Company, he's the co-founder with David K. Johnston of the new investigative reporting news service, DCReport.org, and is the author of Blood Bankers. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.
A lady dressed in white with a man she loved.